So let me invite you to take out your Bibles, whether you have them on a phone or an iPad, or whether it's in written form. This morning we're looking at John, the Gospel of John chapter 15. We're just at the end of our fall sermon series called Bearing Good Fruit. So 2 months ago we began with John chapter 15. We talked about Jesus as the vine, we're the branches. God the Father is the gardener. The Father is pruning us so that we would live lives that are more full of fruits. And now at the end of the series, we come back to John 15, picking up another theme from that passage. So, Seth, if you'd come and read John 15, 1 to 17 for us.
I am the vine, and my Father is the gardener. He cuts off every branch that bears no fruit, while every branch that does bear fruit he prunes, so that it will be even more fruitful. You are already clean because of the word I have spoken to you. Remain in me, as I also remain in you. No branch can bear fruit by itself. It must remain in the vine. Neither can you bear fruit unless you remain in me. I am the vine. You are the branches. If you remain in me, and I in you, you will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. If you do not remain in me, you are like a branch that is thrown away and withers. Such branches are picked up and burned. If you remain in me and my words remain in you, ask whatever you wish, and it will be done for you. This is to my Father's glory, that you will bear much fruit, showing yourselves as my disciples. As the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. Now remain in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will remain in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments, and I remain in his love. I have told you this so that your joy may be complete, and that my joy may be complete in you. My commandment is this: love each other as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. You are my friends if you do what I command. I no longer call you servants, because a servant does not know his master's business. Instead, I've called you friends, for everything that I've learned, I've made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you, and appointed you that you might go and bear fruit, fruit that will last, and so that whatever you ask in my name, the Father will give you. This is my commandment: love each other.
So let me begin this morning with a quote, and I quote from certain people, and maybe you kind of pick that up, you know, more often than others. So this morning I'm quoting again from C.S. Lewis, his book Mere Christianity, and then following up with a bit of a commentary on his quotes that comes from the book that I got the quote from. So C.S. Lewis says, "All that we call human history, money, poverty, ambition, war, prostitution, classes, empires, slavery, all of it is the long, terrible story of humans trying to find something other than God which will make them happy." And then the author of the book says, "Simply put, the driving motive in history is the desire for happiness. All sin, from slavery to racism to terrorism to extortion to the sparks that ignite world wars, all are driven by a desire for happiness apart from God." Now, if you have a sermon outline in your bulletins, I think that quote is in there. So if you thought that was a lot to listen to, you can look at that again. But I'm wondering what you think about that quote. Basically, all of human history is an attempt to be happy without God. Most of it. There are maybe some moments where we say, oh, people are trying to be happy with God, or finding their happiness in God. But that's a fairly bold claim, to say that all of human history is this journey to find happiness without God. And some of us might say, well, I'm not sure if that's true. And even if it is, again, very bold and talking about a very universal reality, not just true of a few people, but the authors are saying that's true of all humans throughout all of human history. And I just want to pick up on the theme of this kind of universal claim that the quote is making, because believe it or not, so often on Sunday mornings, I think we're dealing with fairly universal themes or claims or things that are part of the human condition. It might not always feel like that, and we might wonder sometimes, how is this connected with the universal human plight or the universal human experience? But I think so often we are not talking about two different realities. Like here we have the church reality, the Christian reality, and then we go out in the world and it's a totally different reality. Well, I think so often on Sunday mornings, the reality that the Bible's talking about even this morning is a reality we will find in the world outside as well, the world that we inhabit. But it's spoken of from a different perspective. So last week we were talking, I think, about the universal human reality. We love to find people who have character. We love to vote for people who have the right character. And what person out there could we vote for who will give us the character we want so much in a leader? And I don't know if I said it well enough, but I was trying to say we're not going to find it in a president or a prime minister. The Bible says that the character you long for will happen through faith in Jesus as he brings the Spirit to bear on our lives. And we talked about the character of the fruit of the Spirit. And this morning, as we think about this universal longing for joy or for happiness, and I know some of us might not connect those two words, I'm quite willing to do that, connect joy and happiness. Others might say, that's not the same. Okay. But whether or not it is, I think there is a universal longing to be joyful, or whatever word you want to use. And that universal longing is not going to be found, the Bible will say, and the Christian church will testify, hopefully, it's not going to be found in something out there. If I have more of this or more of that or less of that or less of this, this morning again, the call is not so much to something but to someone. Now, as I'm thinking about, I'm kind of going on a little bit of a bunny trail this morning, a little bit of a rabbit, just a little off the course, but I do know that sometimes I get a little bit of feedback from a few of you, and it's good. It's good. I know that sometimes I'll hear, you know, we don't hear enough about certain things on Sunday morning. Relationships, politics, sexuality, money, power, and making the message practical for our lives. And I would say, I think you're right. To expect, I think, all of that on Sunday morning is a lot to ask of anyone. But I think you're right. I think we need places where we can hear from a Christian perspective on a lot of these things. I would add to the list that I know I don't, and we don't as a church, I think, talk enough about joy. And I think because of that, my deduction is that because I don't or we don't talk a lot about joy in the Christian faith, I think the impression sometimes is that the Christian faith is rather joyless. Rather, who said that? Herman. Boring, right? Kind of emotionless or stoical. Stoical, because pastors are serious. I'm pretty serious, usually. Right? Yeah, others might say that's true of, you know, churches sometimes can be serious. Worship services can be on the serious side. Again, that can be personality, could be culture, but we have to recognize that, I think. This morning I want to recognize that. That when we hear in the outside world, boy, the Christian faith and your pastor is pretty serious. So yeah, that's right, that's not the way it's supposed to be. The Christian faith, although maybe perceived by others as rather joyless, is supposed to be a place, an environment in which we experience joy, believe it or not. So this morning I want to really focus on John 15:11. I find them incredible words. Jesus said, "I've told you these things so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete." So three things about this one verse. I'm going to spend most of my time on number one and number two and just a few seconds on number three. So three things about this verse. The first thing is, I just want to emphasize, and I think we need to do this, is that Jesus is joyful. Again, some people, whether someone's in the church, someone's outside the church, might say the Jesus that I hear about or the Jesus presented to me, again, seems very emotionless, very boring, very almost like putting on a, he just has a serious face all the time, almost kind of hovering above the ground, not really connected to this reality. That can be the impression that sometimes we give or people might have of Jesus. But if you were to read through the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you would find that Jesus expresses love and grief and compassion and anger and gratitude and wonder and desire. And the list goes on of all the emotions that the Gospels tell us Jesus had. And the one example I want to focus on just for a few moments this morning is found earlier on, the Gospel of John chapter 12, Jesus talking with his disciples, a few of them. He's thinking about his upcoming death and suffering. And John 12:27, Jesus says, "Now my soul is greatly distressed." Now that is actually, I would call it a Christian way of translating that verse. My soul is greatly distressed. In another gospel, the translators have actually translated that word differently, I think better. In the Gospel of Matthew, we have, you know, try and imagine this. The disciples on the water, on the Sea of Galilee, there's a storm happening, there's some waves happening. It's pitch black, right? There are no headlights or street lights or lights on your phone. It's just maybe the moonlights, but it's dark. The waves are choppy. And here comes a figure walking on the water. And they say, "It's a ghost." Are they distressed? Well, they are, but the actual translation is they are terrified. They're terrified because they think Jesus walking on the water is a ghost. Now, the same word is used here, so I don't want to say Jesus is distressed, certainly, but he is terrified when he's thinking about his upcoming suffering and death. And I just want to highlight that this morning to say Jesus is not floating above our, or above the earth, somehow immune to all the things that we go through. If you were going to suffer like Jesus did, you'd be rightly terrified as he was. Now this morning I want to focus on Jesus not terrified, but Jesus full of joy. Like the Gospel of Luke says in chapter 10, he was full of joy through the Holy Spirit and was speaking to his disciples. Or this morning when Jesus says, "I've told you these things so that my joy..." So we have to assume there's some joy in Jesus. And what kind of joy is in Jesus? Well, I think it's the joy, I'm going to call it the deepest kind of joy you could experience, because he knows that his Father in heaven loves him. But not only loves him, the Bible says, is pleased with him. And we should use a language of the Father delights in the Son. So we have this in a few places in the Gospels, but especially at the baptism, where the voice from heaven, the voice of the Father says, "You are my Son whom I love. With you I am well pleased," or "with you I delight." So the joy of Jesus, my joy, Jesus says, I'm going to suggest this morning, is rooted in a reality of being loved by the Father. And this is where all joy comes from. So I want you to think about, if you're a joyful person, generally joyful, or if you've experienced moments of joy in your life, I'm going to come to one moment in a few moments where some of us might be able to connect. I'm going to suggest every moment of joy is rooted in the reality of being loved. That's my thesis this morning, thesis number one. All real and lasting joy is rooted in a conviction of being totally and fully loved. Unbreakable. Thesis number two, connected with number one, is joy is lacking in our lives, in our marriages, our families, our friendship, here at Nelson Avenue, when we don't feel totally and fully loved. So if you're someone who's not sure if they're loved, either by God or by someone in your life, your joy will be diminished to the extent you don't feel loved by someone else or by God. When we're loved, when we know there's nothing that can break that love, we are the most joyful of people. We become the most joyful of people. So this past week, maybe some of you saw this on Facebook. Our family was gathered around the computer one night, and we were watching a video about a young couple. I won't say who they are. But a young couple was going for a walk in the woods. And sometimes they were walking together, and sometimes they were walking hand in hand, and sometimes they were walking one in front of the other, and different shots of them, very, very well done. And we all knew that the video was an engagement video, so we know where this is going. But this young woman, didn't quite know where the video was going. It was being shot. So at the end of the video, we have the man, the young man, drop to his knee and ask this young woman to marry him. And what happened for her, and what happened maybe for some of us when that happened in our lives, is this kind of rush of joy. Sometimes it comes, it looks like they're crying because they're not sad. They're just so full of joy. And I want to suggest that moment of dropping to the knee and taking out the ring or asking the question, the joy doesn't come because the ring is so nice. Right? The joy doesn't come because, wow, it was a very nice view. They were gone on this nice walk and this nice view. The joy doesn't come, oh, what a nice place for you to ask me. That's not where the joy comes. I want to suggest the joy comes because this couple, I'm going to say he, said, "I don't just like you. I love you. And not just that, but I want to go move into a relationship with you that for the rest of our lives we hope will be unbreakable." Right? I want to have this experience of unbreakable love in this lifetime with you. And I suggest that's where the joy comes from. Where someone says, "I love you that much that I want to have that experience with you. I want you to experience my unbreakable love for you." And so that's what I think is happening for Jesus. Because he knows the Father loves him with an unbreakable love from everlasting to everlasting, his joy is the greatest, deepest joy in the universe. There is no greater joy than the joy of Jesus. And that's why the second point, Jesus is joyful. We have to have this, I think, as a bedrock conviction of who Jesus was. But not just that, I think more strikingly, almost more strikingly, is that Jesus wants us to have the same joy. I've told you things that my joy might be in you. So not just upon you or around you, but actually in your guts or in your hearts, a place where you can't lose it. So my third thesis, you know, first of all, joy is connected to love. If you don't feel loved, or you don't feel like you're the beloved, someone's beloved, your joy will diminish. And my third thesis, which was actually my first ever tweet that I sent out this past week on Twitter. I had this Twitter account kind of dormant, not doing much with it. But I thought, this is pretty good, I think. So my third thesis is, focused on this verse, Jesus is more interested in, committed to, and desirous for our joy than we are. He wants us to be joyful more than we want ourselves to be joyful. And that happens, I think, when we figure out what Jesus is trying to tell us in this passage. This experience of being loved, of being beloved. So if my thesis is right, that joy comes from a sense of being loved, I think it's right, then Jesus is going to tell us a number of times how loved we are. So I want to get to that this morning. This past week I was reading a recent book by one of my favorite authors, and he said that about 20 years ago, 30 years ago in his life, he had been to a conference, and the speaker had said, I'm going to give you one verse in the Bible. I know it sounds really, really crazy, but one verse in the Bible. I'm going to ask you, don't talk to anyone, 30 minutes, just keep reading that verse and write down 30 things about that verse, 30 reflections on one verse in the Bible. Now, he said the first 2 minutes, pretty easy, pretty good. Minute 5 or 10, 15 got a lot harder. But he said people who could actually do that past 25 up to 30 minutes by the end, the general consensus was that was not just interesting, that was enlightening. If they could push through 30 minutes on one verse, trying to write down 30 things about that one verse, reflections, comments, questions, then something happened. There was like an epiphany. What a verse! So I tried that this past week. I took John 15:11, and one of the reflections I wrote down was that simply what by wanting his disciples to have joy, Jesus is revealing a deep level of love and affection for his disciples. Now there's more I could write, more I did write, but just simply the fact, I want you to have joy. I want you to have my joy. I want you to have this deepest, greatest kind of joy in the universe in you. That longing all by itself is Jesus' attempt to show how much he loves his disciples. And then when Jesus says later on in the passage, greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. His disciples at that moment don't know exactly what that means, but the Gospel of John will show them. Who was the greatest friend? Who showed the greatest love for them? Who laid down their life for them? It turns out to be Jesus who spoke these words. As he lays down his life for his disciples, this is the greatest love. And it's not a love done grudgingly, like, oh, I have to go to the cross. Do I have to die for these guys? Do I have to die for these people? Well, Hebrews 12 tells us that for the joy set before him, he endured the cross. So not a grudging kind of sacrifice. Nobody wants a grudging sacrifice. Then don't sacrifice for me. But if it's a sacrifice gladly done, or done for the sake of joy, wow, what a sacrifice. I don't think this will connect with most of you, so I don't know if I should say it, but It was such a great example. Our family went out a few weeks ago. We watched the movie Trolls. Now, I got a feeling most of you won't watch Trolls because it's a kids' movie, animated movie. But the interesting thing about the movie was that the trolls, I'm trying to remember the details a little bit, but the trolls thought they would be happy if they ate one of the little, I forgot the name. Pops. Oh, sorry. The Bergens, sorry, got that wrong. So the Bergens are these rather not, they don't look too nice. They look really not ugly, we might say. They think if we eat a troll once a year, we're going to be happy. So they have this troll tree. The trolls escape, and they're all upset because they think if we eat a troll, we're going to be happy. It turns out, I think a very biblical theme, it turns out they realize, no, it's not by eating trolls you're going to be happy. It's by giving up your life. It's by sacrificing. It's by looking out for others or doing some crazy thing to help or save someone else. That's where the joy is going to come. And so Jesus, in the same kind of way, is saying, my joy for you will be expressed in this great sacrifice I make for you. I do it for the joy set before me. But I also want you to experience not just I'm suffering, I'm dying, and not even, yes, for you, but this sacrifice is meant to show you the deep, deep love of the Father, my deep, deep love for you. And if you were experienced that, out of that foundation is supposed to come joy. Joy unbreakable. Jesus says later on in the passage, and I'm just going to move quickly through this, he calls us no longer servants, he calls us friends, which is meant to be another way of saying, I really love you. He says, you didn't choose me, I chose you. I really love you. And then as we fast forward to the end of the Gospel of John, I think not just the cross of Jesus, but the resurrection of Jesus is meant to be a place where we see the Father raised Jesus from the dead, how much the Father loves the Son, and how much the Father and the Son love those who will believe in that resurrection. Because the resurrection of Jesus is an event that all those who believe in it, find themselves in it, it will happen to them and to us as well. So as I get ready to end this message, I just go to a quote from N.T. Wright, who said that joy happens when there is a settled conviction that Jesus Christ is really raised from the dead. If we really believe he rose from the dead, if we really believe and see in the resurrection the love of the Father for the Son and the love of the Father and the Son for his creation, including us, if we realize there is a deep, deep fountain of love there, then out of that, again, the foundation of love is meant to come this deep, deep, everlasting joy. And thirdly, so Jesus is joyful. He wants us to be joyful people. And he wants us all to be joyful, but it says at the end, I want you to have complete joy, perfect joy, which is supposed to be a sign, the Old Testament says, when you see people with complete joy or full joy, then you know the Messiah has come. So if we can dig into the love of God for us, and if out of that digging comes joy, that joy is meant to be a sign to the world that the Messiah has really come. Not just out there somewhere, but also come into our lives.